The Eight Immortals Travel East, Chapter 49.
So, imagine for a second that you're, you know, you're looking out your window and you see the actual ocean on fire.
Right, which is just, it's hard to even picture.
Yeah, exactly. Not like a ship burning on the water, but the water itself. Like, it's boiling, it's steaming, and it's literally burning.
It's just an image of total apocalyptic chaos.
It really is. And, you know, in the text we're diving into today, which is this from chapter 49 of the classic Chinese mythological epic Journey to the East, that apocalyptic image isn't just some metaphor. It literally happens.
Yeah, it's a very real event in the narrative.
Right. So our mission today is to unpack this specific narrative because, honestly, it provides this absolute masterclass in how a microscopic, like almost petty conflict can just spiral into absolute catastrophe.
Oh, absolutely. And it also shows how a seemingly, you know, absolute military victory can instantly become a fatal tactical blunder.
Totally. So we're basically getting a front row seat to this rapid conflict escalation, some really devastating family tragedy, and honestly, some incredibly sophisticated military strategy.
Right. We're tracking how this very minor theft turns into a full-blown war between the Dragon Kings of the Seas and this group of incredibly powerful beings known as the It Immortals.
Yeah, and the sheer scale of the escalation here is what just grabs you immediately. Like, we go from a stolen glowing jade board to someone literally weaponizing an entire ocean basin.
It escalates so incredibly fast.
It really does. So let's set the scene here. We open on Ao Run, who is the Dragon King of the South Sea.
Right, the South Sea.
Yeah, and he's sitting in his palace, and he looks out and sees this ominous smoke and dust rising over the neighboring East Sea.
Which is obviously a huge red flag.
Definitely. So he asks his guards what's going on, and they deliver the news that the East Sea Dragon King is at war with the Eight Immortals.
And before Ao Run can even send scouts out to verify this, the doors to his hall just burst open, and it is absolute pandemonium.
Right. It's just chaos.
Exactly. Because it's his brother, the East Sea Dragon King, arriving with his wife and his family. But, you know, he isn't arriving with this grand royal retinue for a state visit.
No, not really.
He is arriving as a weeping, desperate refugee. I mean, he's lost everything.
Which is wild to think about. A dragon king, a literal deity of the ocean, showing up like a refugee. So when Ao Run asks his brother, what on earth could have happened to displace a deity, we get the inciting incident. And it starts so small.
It really does. It's almost trivial.
Right. The EC King explains that an immortal named Lan Kaihi was traveling across the sea, and he was riding this glowing jade board. And this board was, like, shining its light all over the underwater palace.
It's basically a highly visible magical artifact.
Yeah, exactly. So the EC King's eldest son, this prince named Moji, sees this glowing board, decides he wants it.
And that theft right there, that is the spark that lights the powder keg. Because, you know, the immortals are not really the type to just file a diplomatic complaint.
No, definitely not.
Right. So another immortal, Lu Chunyang, who is also known as Lu Dongbin, he immediately leads troops down into the ocean by force.
And it just goes disastrously wrong for the Dragon King's family.
Yeah.
Like, the text describes Lu Chunyang and his troops engaging the eldest son, Moji, in this direct lethal battle. And Moji is killed.
Yeah, he dies right there.
And seeing this, his younger brother, the second son of the Dragon King, rushes into the fray to save him, or, you know, maybe to avenge him. And the second son gets his arm severed, and he dies in the battle as well.
It's just brutal. In the span of a single afternoon, two princes are dead.
Just gone.
Right. And the East Sea King tells Ao Run that his heart was immediately consumed with absolute blinding hatred. I mean, naturally. He personally went out to fight the immortals to avenge his sons, but he was completely outmaneuvered.
He just didn't stand a chance.
No, she was ambushed from four sides and thoroughly defeated.
Man, just looking at this from a pure behavioral perspective, the retaliation is mind-boggling. It's like someone stealing a skateboard from your front lawn, and your response is to deploy a heavily armed tactical unit that wipes out half of the thief's family.
That is a very accurate, if slightly modernized, way to look at it.
But, you know, I want to push on the EC Dragon King's narrative here for a second.
Yeah.
Because does he take any actual responsibility for his son's initial theft? Or is he purely playing the victim here to manipulate his brother into providing military support?
Well, you know, you could look at it as him playing the victim to get troops, sure. But we have to look really closely at the language in the source text.
Okay, what does the text say?
The EC King does technically admit the initial fault. He uses specific phrasing, acknowledging that his son Moji, quote, improperly seized the jade board.
Oh, interesting. So he admits it was stolen.
Yes. He isn't pretending his son was this innocent bystander who was attacked entirely unprovoked. However, you are right that his narrative focus completely ignores the theft itself. But, you know, think about the psychology of escalation here.
Right.
Once that massive lethal retaliation happens, the original context just sort of evaporates.
Because the punishment is so wildly disproportionate to the crime.
Precisely. The debate over who was originally right or wrong about the jade board, it just ceases to matter the second two sons are slaughtered.
Yeah, the scale tips completely.
Exactly. The escalation creates an entirely new reality. The initial offense is basically erased by the trauma of the disproportionate response. So the only thing that exists now in his mind is the fresh grief and this absolute demand for retribution.
Okay, so the deaths of his sons explain the E.C. King's grief. I get that. But grief doesn't make you a homeless refugee. Like, how does a king who literally controls the ocean get violently evicted from it in a single afternoon?
Ah, well, that is where the immortals demonstrate the terrifying scale of their power. I mean, they didn't just win a border skirmish or push the Dragon King back into his palace.
Right. They went way further.
They employed the scorched earth magic that fundamentally altered the elemental reality of the whole region.
Yeah, this part is wild. The E.C. King tells his brother that the immortals used their magic to literally boil the ocean. They dried up the water of the East Sea entirely.
Which is just an unfathomable level of magic.
It is. And then once it was dry, they set the underwater Dragon Palace on fire. And they've basically occupied the smoking ruins. And the E.C. King describes it to Eowrun with this really chilling phrase. He says, man dead, country broken.
Man dead, country broken. It's so evocative.
Right. He has no home, nowhere to turn. So he's begging his brother to remember their blood bond, you know, to take him in and raise an army for revenge.
And let's unpack the mechanics of what boiling an ocean actually signifies in this specific mythology, because it's not just a cool trick. It is an absolute subversion of the natural order.
Wow.
Well, Eowrun is the South Sea Dragon King, right?
Right.
His entire domain, his entire identity is water. So the idea of an enemy possessing the thermal magical energy required to just evaporate a sea and then burn an aquatic palace, that is an existential threat to him.
Because if they can do it to the East Sea, they can do it to the South Sea.
Exactly. It's this incredible ecological devastation meant to instill deep psychological terror. And Eowrun's reaction is just immediate fury. Interestingly, though, he also acknowledges the initial theft.
Oh, he does.
Yeah, he tells his brother that, hey, if the jade board was stolen, the immortals definitely had a right to ask for it back. But he fiercely condemns their tactics.
He asks how they could dare to run so rampant, just, you know, killing and setting fires. And it's such a paradox, right? Setting an underwater palace on fire. It proves that the immortals' power just completely overrides the very laws of physics.
It's the ultimate flex of dominance.
But I gotta challenge Eowrun's moral high ground here, too. I mean, he is calling out the immortals for their extreme, unhinged overreaction. But by instantly promising to use his entire army to get revenge for his brother, isn't Eowrun just falling into the exact same trap of endless escalation? Like, he's guaranteeing more death.
It definitely looks like a trap of endless escalation from the outside, certainly. But, you know, from Eowrun's perspective, within this mythological framework, inaction equals death.
Because of the existential threat you mentioned.
Right. He isn't just seeking petty revenge. He's reacting to that massive threat. If the immortals are willing and able to literally boil the East Sea over a stolen piece of jade,
right,
what stops them from boiling his sea next?
Wow. Yeah, that's a terrifying thought.
Furthermore, there is the strong cultural mandate of, and this is the exact phrasing the E.C. King uses, snowing a great shame.
Snowing a great shame.
Yeah, basically washing away the humiliation.
Yeah.
When you are hit by an attack of sheer, overwhelming scale, like having your entire nation boiled away, it forces the defending side into an all or nothing survival mindset.
There's no middle ground anymore.
Exactly. There's no room for a negotiated peace when the enemy is currently occupying the burnt remains of your home.
Right. The scale of the immortals' victory basically guaranteed a massive counterattack because, well, they left the Dragon Kings with absolutely nothing else to lose.
They backed a deity into a corner, and you never want to do that.
So what does this mean for Eowrun tactically? Because he is now committed to a war. But how do you defeat an elite force of magical beings who just prove they are powerful enough to boil an entire ocean?
It's a huge problem.
Yeah. You obviously can't just march your troops up to them in a standard formation.
Yeah.
Which brings us to, honestly, the most fascinating tactical shift in the entire source text.
Absolutely, because Ao Run is angry, yes, but he is also incredibly calculating. He doesn't just like charge out the door waving a sword. He immediately asks his brother for intelligence.
He wants the data.
Right, he asks for the exact number of troops the Eight Immortals are commanding.
And the brother says, few but elite.
Which is good to know. But then Ao Run asks the most critical question in any military campaign. He asks, where are they stationed right now?
And the EC King tells him, they are occupying my dried-out dragon palace. And this, learner, is the moment everything flips.
It's such a brilliant realization.
It is. You would expect Ao Run to despair at this news. Like, the enemy is literally sitting on his brother's throne. But he is thrilled. He declares that by occupying that specific spot, the Immortals have essentially sent themselves to death.
Because he realizes the topography of the battlefield has fundamentally shifted, and the Immortals are completely blind to it.
Totally blind.
Ao Run outlines this tactical reality. If the Immortals were up on high, dry ground, fighting them would be an absolute nightmare.
Oh, for sure.
The Dragon King's aquatic troops would have to, you know, form ranks, march up an incline completely out of their element, and fight a traditional battle against beings with overwhelming magical supremacy.
Right, which is exactly what the EC King tried to do initially, and he got crushed. But the Immortals dried out the ocean. And then they marched down and set up camp in the ruins of the underwater palace.
Down at the very bottom.
Right. They put themselves at the lowest possible elevation point in a massive geographical basin. They voluntarily surrendered the high ground.
Which is a fatal error.
So Ao Run reveals his master plan. They're going to break the waters of the four surrounding seas and just flood the entire EC basin all at once.
It's genius.
He notes that under millions of gallons of rushing, crushing water, it just doesn't matter if the Immortals have a million troops or these sky-reaching martial arts. Their combat skills will be entirely useless against the sheer hydrodynamic pressure of four converging oceans.
It is geographical judo. I mean, he is using the enemy's own momentum and their physical position entirely against them.
It's like, imagine a gang of bullies who win a turf war by draining a giant municipal swimming pool.
Right.
They celebrate, they climb down the ladder, and they set up their victory camp right at the very bottom of the deep end, feeling completely untouchable.
Oh, I see where this is going.
Yeah, they are so busy celebrating their dominance that they totally forgot who controls the municipal water hoses.
That captures the profound strategic irony perfectly. The Immortals' ultimate flex-like, their display of supreme power in drying the ocean, was the very action that constructed their own topographical trap.
They dug their own grave.
Exactly. They thought the dried ocean was the symbol of their untouchable dominance, but it was actually a kill box.
It's a massive blind spot. Like, you win the battle, you take the prize, but you position yourself to lose the war simply because you aren't looking at an elevation map.
Which, you know, is a brilliant lesson for the learner to take away from this myth. In business strategy, in negotiations, whatever, an overwhelming victory can create severe tunnel vision.
You get too focused on the win.
Right. You can become so hyper-focused on taking the prize, in this case, occupying the palace, that you fail to realize the prize itself is an undefendable, highly vulnerable position.
Okay, so Ao Run has a brilliant plan. But, you know, a brilliant plan on paper is completely worthless without execution.
Execution is everything.
Exactly. And to instantly flood an entire ocean basin, you can't just walk over and turn on a giant tap. He needs massive coordinated logistical backup. I mean, this isn't a one dragon job. This requires moving millions of tons of water simultaneously.
The logistics of this operation are staggering. We actually get a very detailed look at the rapid mobilization of this mythological coalition, and Ao Run doesn't hesitate for a second.
He's moving fast.
Very fast. He immediately drafts two urgent letters and sends his most trusted rapid messengers to the West Sea Dragon King and the North Sea Dragon King.
So he's pulling in the entire family network. The South, West, and North Seas are all going to converge on the East.
Right. And the coordination he demands is incredibly specific. Ao Run's letters propose a simultaneous multi-front strike at a very specific time, the fifth watch of the night.
The fifth watch.
Yes. So he coordinates a strike for that pitch black hour right before dawn, when visibility is at its absolute lowest and the enemy is most likely resting.
What really fascinates me is the trigger mechanism for the attack. Mm-hmm. Because it's not a flare or some visual signal, obviously, because it's going to be pitch black.
Right. Visual wouldn't work.
So the text says the trigger will be continuous, rapid-fire signal cannons.
Which makes perfect sense when you consider the physics of their environment.
Oh, because of the water.
Exactly. Water is significantly denser than air, meaning sound travels much faster and further. So these aren't cannons firing cannonballs into the sky. These are concussive shock waves traveling through the deep water.
Oh, wow. That's so clever.
It's an auditory signal that only aquatic beings submerged in the surrounding seas would feel and recognize. It completely bypasses the immortals, who are sitting in a dry basin relying on surface-oriented senses.
They wouldn't even know what was happening until it was too late. So the West and North Dragon Kings received the letters, and they agree to the plan immediately. They send word back that they will have the water primed and ready, waiting only for the sound of the cannons.
The coalition is locked in.
Yeah. So Elrond gets the confirmations, and then the internal mobilization begins. He deploys 40 of his own water officers.
Okay.
And their job isn't just to open the floodgates. They are sent out to lead troops and actively manage the incoming floodwaters from all four sides.
And we really have to consider what those 40 officers are actually doing. I mean, this is hydroengineering on a magical scale.
Managing the flow.
Exactly. They have to shape the hydrodynamic pressure fronts. If the water just trickles in, the immortals can escape. The officers have to coordinate the currents so the water crashes down on the basin simultaneously, preventing the immortals from basically riding the wave up to safety.
That is intense. And on top of that, Elrond mobilizes 100,000 elite troops of his own to just dive into the chaos once the water hits, fully armored and ready for aquatic combat.
It's a massive coordinated assault.
And amidst all this massive troop movement and, you know, elemental magic, Elrond makes what might be his most astute leadership decision in the entire text.
Oh, about his brother.
Yes. He turns to his brother, the grieving, defeated EC King, and puts him in charge of military oversight. He makes him the superintendent of the army.
It's a fascinating choice. Why do you think he does that?
I really think he's doing it to channel his brother's despair into something actionable. I mean, we're talking about a time frame of hours here.
Right, it's very compressed.
They go from the East Sea King collapsing at the door as a broken refugee to orchestrating this multi-ocean, 100,000 troop amphibious assault before breakfast.
Yeah, that's a wild turnaround.
If Elrond had just let his brother sit and stew in his anger, the East Sea King might have rushed back in prematurely and gotten himself killed again, or, well, permanently killed.
That is a crucial insight into Eowyn's command style. He imposes structure on chaos by assigning the East Sea King the role of military overseer. Well, you know, making him responsible for ensuring the troops are fed, their armor is secured, and they are staged for the dawn. A Salt Lerum run basically gives a drowning man a lifeline.
He gives him focus.
Yes. He takes someone who is paralyzed by grief over his dead sons and his ruined kingdom, and he gives him a timeline and a vital purpose.
He just snaps him out of the trauma response by forcing him to focus on the logistics.
And the text continually emphasizes this strict structure. It highlights the precise timing of the Fifth Watch, the clear communication protocol of the concussive cannons, and the delegation of authority to the 40 hydro officers.
It's a machine.
It is. This is not a chaotic mob driven by blind vengeance. It is a highly disciplined coalition reacting with startling efficiency to exploit a tactical error. They eat their rations, they secure their armor, and they sit in the absolute dark, waiting for dawn.
Just waiting to drop an entire ocean on the beings who murdered their nephews. I mean, the tension in that final image is incredible.
It perfectly distills all the themes of the source material. We see how quickly pride and power can blind you to your physical reality.
Absolutely.